For the Life of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Visit us online at faith.yale.edu.
Jesus is not a presidential candidate or a symbolic of purified, divinely blessed America. He's the risen and living Lord of all, the way, the truth, and the life. The salvation he offers is not the success of your political candidate or the realization of your national dream. It is forgiveness of sinners, release of captives, healing of the sick, justice for the poor, resurrection of the dead. Christ is victor, and we may humbly hope to be more than conquerors through him. But his victory came in and through a scandalous shame and seeming defeat of the cross. We must restore confidence in our democracy and trust in each other. Suspicion and conspiracy theories have distorted and disconnected us from reality. We must live constantly from the deep truth that our worth doesn't come from victory, triumph, or any other kind of power or influence. Our worth is secured by the love of God for us. May we all become instruments of peace in this time of conflict.
This is For the Life of the World, a podcast about seeking and living a life worthy of our humanity. I'm Evan Rosa with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. My friends, as we recently announced, now through May 1st, 2022, we'll be running highlights, stories, and other best of moments from the first 100 episodes of For the Life of the World, as well as lectures, readings, and other resources produced by the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Today, as we pass the first anniversary of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, 2021, here are a few perspectives on the attack itself, on the state of democracies in America and abroad, and what it takes to make or break a democracy. To begin, a clip from episode 46. One day after the attack, Miroslav Volf spoke about its ramifications and outlined how people of faith should respond.
I'm Miroslav Volf with the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. Hello, friends. Like many of you, my colleagues and I have been deeply troubled and grieved by the events of the past 24 hours. And we felt an urgency to affirm together the thoughts I am sharing with you here. Many leaders, politicians, pastors, journalists have already spoken up. We joined that chorus in hope that our thoughts and words will help heal our divided country, divided church, and divided humanity, and heal that divided community with the love and peace of Christ. Yesterday afternoon, a violent mob supporting a president who refuses to acknowledge the uncontestable fact of his defeat in the last November's election attacked and occupied our nation's Capitol building. The immediate sequence of events that led to this attempted insurrection is clear. President Trump spread false allegations of electoral fraud since before the election itself, stoking fear, anger, racial resentment, and suspicion. He recruited Republican politicians into supporting his election fraud claims. He recklessly called for protests on the day Congress was to certify the election results. And yesterday, he spoke to his protesting supporters and incited them to violent action, which many of them enthusiastically undertook. In the midst of the violent occupation, rather than quickly and clearly condemning the mob to protect our nation's capital, he coddled and embraced him, saying, "Go home. We love you. You're very special." The most responsible thing to say about the president's and the attacker's action is that they were, without qualification, wrong. To praise, to condone, to excuse, or to ignore them is to call evil good. Put darkness for light. Put bitter for sweet. We are encouraged to see so many Christian leaders already naming yesterday's wrongdoing for what it was. And we call on all our fellow followers of Christ to do the same. At the heart of the current effort to deny and overturn the results of presidential election is the wounded pride of a man who cannot handle the truth of his own imperfection and the fact that he lost a fair democratic contest. There is a sorrowful, pathetic smallness to this petty woundedness, even as it produces momentous and tragic consequences. Faced with painful reality that conflict with his self-image, but that he cannot control, President Trump has given himself over to wishful thinking, conspiracy theories, and falsehood. He has constructed a pseudo-truth to fit the needs of his immense but fragile and wounded pride. Many Americans have taken his lie to be their truth. Sadly but unsurprisingly, among them are many who call themselves Christians. Many of the attackers yesterday claimed, quite literally, the banner of Jesus Christ. They displayed flags that said, "Jesus 2020, and signs that said, "Jesus saves," right alongside Trump banners and the Confederate flag. It was not only moral failure at work and on display, but also a theological distortion. The roots of these events are not exclusively theological, but they are theological and they're deeply theological. Jesus is not a presidential candidate or a symbolic of purified, divinely blessed America. He's the risen and living Lord of all, the way, the truth, and the life. The salvation he offers is not the success of your political candidate or the realization of your national dream. It is forgiveness of sinners, release of captives, healing of the sick, justice for the poor, resurrection of the dead. Christ is victor, and we may humbly hope to be more than conquerors through him. But his victory came in and through a scandalous shame and seeming defeat of the cross. What we saw yesterday will draw out very deep human emotions. We feel afraid for ourselves, our country, our children, our neighbors. We feel blinding anger and frustration over the lies, the corruption, the racism, the violence, the insanity. But each of us must wrestle with the question of what we will do with that fear and that anger. We do not have the power and the influence of a president, but none of us is without consequence. Our individual and collective agency is a gift from God that we must in turn give to each other for Christ's sake and for humanity's sake. What must we do? We must commit firmly to truth, even and especially when it hurts our pride, when we lose, when it calls for sacrifice. we must orient ourselves toward peace and bearing with one another, being ready to forgive as we have been forgiven. Indeed, our commitment to the truth is never at odds with love of neighbor. Peace is in fact unintelligible and unimaginable apart from the truth of Christ. We must stand up for the downtrodden, marginalized, and afflicted, speaking and acting on their behalf for their good, for their healing, and for their inclusion in flourishing. We must never compromise or distort Christian faith in service to the idol of political power. We must restore confidence in our democracy and trust in each other. Suspicion and conspiracy theories have distorted and disconnected us from reality. We must live constantly from the deep truth that our worth doesn't come from victory, triumph, or any other kind of power or influence. Our worth is secured by the love of God for us. May we all become instruments of peace in this time of conflict. Thank you, our listeners and our friends.
The events of January 6th have fueled an ongoing debate about the state of democracy in the U.S., but the crises that undergird this moment stretch across the globe. The next two clips we'll play come from philosopher Charles Taylor in episode 87 and novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson in episode 35. Each of them are deeply concerned for the state of democracies, both in America and across the world.
We have a sense that democracy is in crisis in many areas of the world, that it's in crisis in the West in terms of its motivation, whether that comes from Silicon Valley or from other sources. But democracy itself, there's a sense something's wrong about it. It's not quite functioning as it ought to be functioning. And then this presents itself as a Christian alternative, rooted deeply in the Christian tradition to that crisis. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I'm really horrified by the inability of all these integralist movements to keep themselves separate from the worst elements of the present rebellion against what I consider healthy democracy. I mean, take the American scene. Great deal of these integralist movements are voting for Trump. Trump is just such it would be laughable if it weren't triable, if it didn't make you burst into tears. These people are, in a sense, in the long run, condemning themselves. They're doing something to the Christian faith, which will turn, future generations off in the most, I think, powerful way. I mean, they always seem to end up on the side of there's something similar happening in France with certain kinds of very integralist Catholicism, which Marine Le Pen is appealing to. And there, the vehicle is bashing Muslims and so on. And so this is not an exciting new development in history. This is not something that will end up exciting future generations and who are dying to join this. this is very much a dead end. But it is a threat. I mean, it's certainly a threat. Trump almost pulled off a coup d'etat, and that would be just so catastrophic for the Western democratic world that I don't even want to consider it too much. So it's not as though we're saved from terrible historical deviations which have real, really powerful effect on people's lives. But we have something which is spiritually, I think, very, very dead in there.
And now, Miroslav Volf asks Marilyn Robinson about her love for American democracy and what makes it work.
Especially in the last 5 years, we have seen increasingly how democracy has lost on reputation for various reasons. And one can say that in some ways, democracy is in crisis. And that's not just because of an authoritarian president. It's because various reasons, but also in particular, young people seem not to care particularly much for democracy. It's they're interested more in achieving certain ends than in the means by which those ends are achieved. And I, as I was listening and thinking about that, it reminded me of the days after the downfall of Soviet Union, when Russia was going through a certain kind of economic also crisis. And the question was, what's going to happen with democracy? And when I talked to some of my friends there, you know, most people, they said, think, you know, if we are going to choose between bread and democracy, we're going to choose bread. Right now, some people might think, well, if we need to choose between prosperity and democracy, we're going to choose prosperity. And if we need to choose between whatever it is, that's what we are going to choose, as if democracy were not a value in its own right. So could you speak about your interest in democracy, what democracy, not just in what democracy can achieve?
First of all, and this is not anything that describes my love of democracy, that we are now, as all our politicians tell us, the wealthiest culture that ever lived on Earth. We have a history of, you know, democracy by the degree that this thing has been achieved that made us richer and richer and richer through generations of time. Now, if people feel that they are so hard-pressed materially that they're going to throw over this great historical project, we are in trouble, because that really, that's very unadmirable, you know. As far as democracy itself is concerned, I think that from moment to moment, from person to person, there's a capacity for great insight, for great integrity, and so on. Not in any of us consistently, but overall, if we're attentive to each other, we have those things to learn from each other and to be guided by. There is no other way of trying to tap this potential that exists in human beings other than democracy.
Right. It's a form of also deliberating about our common project, shaping it together, but also that project itself is a project of deliberation. I can just think of wonderful conversations that happen and exchanges that happen that are fruits of democracy, or at least of kind of stances at a maybe smaller scale that we might want to foster at a larger scale in democratic politics.
Mm-hmm. I think that we have to try to give other people grounds for optimism. I mean, you know, usually when your opinion is solicited by the general, you know, by the practices of democracy, you should be taking care that you have something of value to offer, I think. You know, we tend to slight that side of democracy.
Hmm. What do you think are the kind of cultural conditions of democracy? I know democratic functioning is dependent on many things. Some of them have to do with the way political institutions are set up. Others have to do about how our economy is set up, maybe educational system. But there are also kind of more narrowly cultural values that have to be nurtured for democracy to be healthy.
I think that's true. I think that, but again, you know, when you look at old books that are about American democracy, the assumption was clearly present that we have to be sure that people have adequate historical understanding, for example, you know, that they, you know, that basic education is made available at the widest possible sort, you know, so on. We haven't looked, we act as if democracy were just a slightly more complicated way of drawing straws or something, when in fact the assumption behind it is that the society will acculturate people to feel that they have soundly based opinions and that they are free to express them.
But even earlier, I agree. So it's a kind of a nurturing, discerning judgment and the mind in terms of through education and other means. But I'm just wondering also, about the sacred, presumably something like a sense that human beings are in whatever way sacred. Maybe everybody won't express it in terms of sacredness, but that they demand our respect. And so it seems to me that anything that undermines the respect for each individual person, today we think of the discourse that we're gotten used to, where we have this barrage of disfemisms that are unleashed upon, especially one's adversaries. They're monsters, they're animals. It reminds me of earlier vocabulary during Nazi Germany. They're all vermin, and similar things you had in Rwanda. Whenever you have this strong conflicts, people tend to want to dehumanize other human beings, let alone hold them as sacred.
Finally, in June 2021, I invited journalist Kevin Lau and theologian Andrew Kwok, both from Hong Kong, to come on the show to discuss the spirituality of social action in Hong Kong and its implications for freedom of speech, freedom of the press, so much more freedom. At the end of our interview, they shared their hopes for the future of Hong Kong, for global democracy, and for healing.
From the perspective of the rest of the world, in general, internationally, we're seeing the rise of identitarian politics. We're seeing democracy begin to crumble in different parts of the world. The experiment of finding a shared truth in a shared public space and then seeking flourishing in that is crumbling even in the US. And so from the perspective of Hong Kong people, Hong Kong Christians in particular, what is your hope for the future of peace and the hope of democracy?
For me, I think that non-Western Christians would like US Christians to live up a good Christian democracy in their country. I think US Christianity and democracy, you have a very long tradition, relationship with religion and democracy. But in the last few years, what happened in US Christianity and US society is very disappointing for those who look up for a democratic example in governance or in social order. And for a non-Western Christian, we always think that democracy is an outcome of Christian spirituality. Without that spirituality or without that Christian spirit or lifestyle, actually, democracy cannot work. Democracy cannot be a peaceful social order but run into a chaotic interest groups conflicts, just like every day in every part of the world. And so that I think the relationship for peace and democracy from the perspective of non-Western Christians, and I hope that US Christians work harder to think how to revitalize the Christian spirit in their society.
Revitalizing that is absolutely important. I think that kind of public revitalization, as we've gone through this conversation, it's become clear that each of you are committed to the idea that we first need a kind of internal peace. And so, Kevin, what are you thinking about the future of that kind of peace and healing of memory?
It's not just internal peace. It's internal healing, healing of your memory. I remember reading Miroslav Volf's book, The End of Memory. It says you have to grasp tightly onto your identity, that you are the beloved child of God. You have to hold on to it with all your strength. I understand it when I was in the hospital, because when the memory of affection come, you cannot just forget it. You cannot let it grow pale. It won't. You cannot control it, suppress it. It would just suddenly pop up and hurt you and paralyze you again. It's very easy to identify yourself as the victim when those memories of affections and wounds come up. So you have to hold on tight to to your core, to your being, that you are the beloved child of God.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can only face those horrible memory created by the shedding of blood, cannot be overcome by forgetfulness. It can only be overcome by fixing your eyes on the cross in Golgotha.
Mm-hmm.
It can only face your terrible past by looking at the face of Jesus on the cross. That's when the holy memory of the cross start shadowing, overwhelming, overtaking your own memory of the horrible affliction. I experienced that. I went through that. Healing starts from there. It was only with this healing that you become able to face the past, to face your memory, to face the reality. Then you can start hope.
Thanks for listening today, friends. We'll be back next week with an episode in honor of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. Of the World is a production of the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School. This episode featured theologian Miroslav Volf, philosopher Charles Taylor, novelist and essayist Marilyn Robinson, journalist Kevin Lau, and theologian Andrew Kwok. Editorial and production assistance by Logan Ledman. I'm Evan Rosa, and I edit and produce the show. For more information, visit us online at faith.yale.edu. New episodes drop every Saturday, sometimes midweek. If you're new to the show, welcome, friend. Hit subscribe in your favorite podcast listening app, and we'd love your feedback. Ratings and reviews in Apple Podcasts are particularly helpful, but we're just as happy to hear from you by email at faith@yale.edu. We read each comment and do our best to respond and improve the show, bringing you the people and topics that you want to hear. And if you're a regular listener, it's a huge honor that you stick with us from week to week. So I'll ask you to step up and join us. Help us share the show. Behind those three dots in your podcast app, there's an option to share this episode by text or email or social media. If you took a brief moment to send your favorite episode to a friend or share with the world, not only would you be supporting the show, you'd be sparking up a great conversation around stuff that matters with people that matter. Thanks for listening today, friends. We'll be back with more this coming week.